Welcome to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on July 2nd, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and a very warm welcome back from his travels to my co-host, who is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law at the University of Maryland in Baltimore.
Frank, I missed you.
Missed you too, Nick, and thank you for those amazing interviews the day of King v. Burwell. That was great.
It was great fun. Great fun. My thanks to everyone who's involved. We have a wonderful guest today. Ifeoma Ajunwa is a professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia, David A. Clark School of Law, where she teaches health law and IP. She's doing some really interesting work in the genetic discrimination space. There are a lot of topics to discuss today, but in large part, we're going to be rotating around GINA, the anti-discrimination statute. And so if we may, if you would indulge us, Ifeoma, with a sort of a basic introduction to GINA to bring our listeners up to speed on that, and a very warm welcome to you.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm happy to be chatting with you. To talk about GINA, which is the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, it was an anti-discrimination law that was signed into effect in 2008 by George Bush, and it took effect in 2009 with the primary purpose of protecting Americans from genetic discrimination, both in terms of health insurance and employment discrimination. And GINA has two parts. There's Title I, which is the part that protects against discrimination in health insurance, and then there's Title II, which is the part that protects against discrimination in employment. I think today we'll probably be focusing more on Title II, which is essentially enforced by the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And it's important to understand that while GINA protects against genetic discrimination, it does have some limitations. So, for example, it doesn't protect against discrimination for life insurance or long-term care insurance. And it also has some allowances for when some employers can request genetic information. For example, in the case of testing workers who are working in a laboratory setting to ensure that there's no ill effects to their health. But GINA is unequivocal that genetic testing cannot be used as a means to determine whether an employee can be hired or fired from their job.
Well, that is a terrific summary of the relevant law. And one of the reasons we wanted to have you on really badly presently, Ifeoma, is because of your work on disparate impact. And, you know, that has recently been revived in some very big Supreme Court, in a very big Supreme Court case. And also because of something that's very topical in the news now, which was the first case that involved an award of damages with respect to GINA. This was on June 22nd. There was a case against Atlas Logistics Group Retail Services, this grocery distributor. And, you know, this case got a ton of headlines because of the sort of bizarre facts behind it, which were essentially that the employer was upset that someone was leaving fecal matter in their warehouse, and then they went and took two employees that they suspected and swabbed their cheeks and wanted to compare the DNA in the feces to the DNA of these employees. And it's just amazing to me just how far this is from what one might think of as the core, like, hiring, firing for having a genetic problem purposes of GINA. And yeah, it's become the case to sort of put GINA on the map. So I was wondering if you had any take on that, Ifeoma, any particular sort of line on whether this seems like a really the type of case that maybe the framers of GINA were thinking about when they drafted the legislation. And even if it wasn't particular, if they couldn't envision this, perhaps the wisdom of extending GINA because of the clear threat to privacy posed by these types of genetic swabbings.
That's a great question. So the devious defecator case, as you mentioned, was the first GINA case to go to trial. So it wasn't actually the first GINA case ever filed. The first GINA case ever filed by the EEOC actually was Pamela Fink, who was a woman that had been fired after she underwent a prophylactic mastectomy. So she was not sick. She did not have cancer. She underwent genetic testing and discovered that she was carrying the BRCA1, BRCA2 genes, which are gene mutations that are linked to cancer, breast cancer specifically. And she, according to her, she had been a model employee up until after her prophylactic mastectomy, after which she started receiving negative reviews and was subsequently let go from her job. And that case was settled out of court. So, but the devious defecator case is the first case brought under GINA to actually go to trial and also to result in a cash award, a $2.25 million actually cash award for the two plaintiffs. And it is a very interesting case because the men in question were obligated to undergo genetic testing for the purposes of identifying who was leaving feces around the workplace. So it doesn't squarely fit into really. I think it doesn't really squarely fit into the type of employment discrimination that I think the drafters of GINA had in mind, which is that the worker is obligated to undergo genetic testing either prior to hiring or after hiring as a pretext for being fired. In this case, you know, the genetic testing was more being used as a investigative tool, if you will, for the employers to discover who was committing nefarious acts. But the ruling does give GINA teeth because I think a lot of the scholarship around GINA has somewhat been worried that it doesn't have teeth because you still would have to prove intent to discriminate on the basis of genetic profile to win a GINA case, because GINA does not have a disparate impact theory of action. So for this case to prevail is actually giving GINA some teeth and allowing that GINA may be viewed as categorically prohibiting employers from demanding genetic information from employees, whether or not the intent behind that request is employment discrimination. So I think as a result, this is going to really bolster the impact of GINA in the future for employment litigation purposes.
So I'm guessing that everyone who teaches health law desperately hopes this case goes on appeal so that it ends up in case books so that we can teach it in the classroom. But just moving on a little bit, as you say, this case kind of indicates perhaps some gap filling in GINA. We only have a district judge opinion at the moment, the trial court. And I guess the other piece that's been very important in the years after GINA have been the changes in health coverage. I wonder what you think of GINA as a major discrimination tool now in a world in which we have Affordable Care Act guaranteed issue. And whether you can kind of reframe the need of GINA as we move into this new world of healthcare.
That's an excellent question. I mean, despite the passage of the Affordable Care Act, we do have other developments that actually make genetic discrimination a concrete threat that exists in the workplace. So, for example, a little-known fact is that the ACA also has within it a provision for employers to institute what are called workplace wellness programs. And these are programs with the express goal of encouraging workers to lead a healthier lifestyle. So encouraging workers to exercise, encouraging workers to undergo diagnostic testing, for a host of risk factors, encouraging workers to lose weight, encouraging workers to enroll in smoking cessation programs. And while all this, sounds great and sounds very helpful for the employee, it does also expose the employee's information, both health and genetic information, to the eyes of the employer, therefore providing more opportunities for employment discrimination. So as a result, GINA is actually now needed more than ever, because the ACA, by providing incentives for employers to have wellness programs, is actually helping to proliferate these programs in the workplace. And currently, wellness programs are about a $6 billion annual industry in the U.S., and more than 50% of employers now have wellness programs. And most of the employers that have wellness programs are actually large corporations that employ a large number of people. So I don't think the need for GINA has dissipated as a result of the ACA. On the contrary, I actually think it's actually now even needed.
That is such a terrific point, Ifoma, and I'm so glad that you mentioned that ACA and wellness program connection. One, because we've been covering wellness programs on the podcast with some great folks who've been very concerned, but I have not heard in the literature the connection that you are making between the possibility of, say, the genetic underclass that you describe in your paper, the article Genetic Data and Civil Rights, and the type of people who might be penalized under wellness programs. And I think this is, the Genetic Data and Civil Rights paper is so intellectually adventurous and so far-seeing that I'd love for you to describe the vision you have in that for disparate impact law and how it even ties in with the Genetic Non-Discrimination Study Commission that was ordered under GINA.
Great. So my article, The Genetic Data and Civil Rights, really had its impetus in the fact that I discovered that GINA did not have a disparate impact provision. In fact, GINA explicitly prohibits disparate impact as a cause of action. But in so doing, GINA also, the Act, established that a Genetic Non-Discrimination Study Commission would be established starting in 2014 to examine the developing science of genetics and to then make the decision whether a disparate impact clause would be added to GINA. In my article, Genetic Data and Civil Rights, I sort of chat the developing social phenomenon, right, of genetic testing in the U.S., and I make several points, the most poignant of which is that genetic testing has now become ubiquitous in the U.S. In fact, it is so ubiquitous and socially accepted that we scrutinize our genomic profile that I actually am saying that it has now become genetic coercion. And this genetic coercion, I'm saying, is a governmental, social, and moral compulsion for us to scrutinize and police our own genomes. And the governmental compulsion really stems from the fact that in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, the U.S. mandates newborn genetic testing. So all children born in the U.S. Since, I believe, 2008 have undergone genetic testing. And as a result, much of our genetic information is now really outside of our control. And for this reason, and some others, I advocate in the Genetic Data and Civil Rights that GINA does need a disparate impact clause to better protect the rights of American citizens. And excuse me. And you know, I think some of the issues that should be considered in terms of you know, adjudicating whether a disparate impact is really needed is that, for one, the EEOC has declared that proof of deliberate acquisition of genetic discrimination is not necessary to establish a violation of GINA. So what does that mean? It means that the employee does not have to prove that the employer deliberately acquired the genetic information. The employee can merely say that even if the employer accidentally acquired the genetic information but then used it in employment discrimination, that is actionable under GINA. I also argue that real-world instances of genetic testing have shown that even facially neutral testing may result in disparities and may really widen certain inequalities. A case that I use for that last assertion is the NCAA testing of student athletes. So a while back, there had been deaths among NCAA athletes who were collapsing during practice, and some studies had attributed those deaths to people who had the sickle cell trait, and unbeknownst to them, and then who were then dying as a result of what is called exertional sickling, which happens during intense exercise or in high altitudes. And as a result, the NCAA reached a settlement with some of the families of the people that died, and part of that settlement was mandating sickle cell trait testing for all NCAA athletes. But already, you know, some concerned scholars noticed that this was also then being used by the professional football teams to decide who they would seek to recruit and who they would not, because obviously the employer has a vested interest in having an athlete that's not going to collapse on the field. So we do have to be careful, because even facially neutral testing can result in disparities and people being excluded for employment.
So let me follow up a little bit on that article. First of all, I guess you must have been cheered as the author of that piece by the Fair Housing Act ruling last week. I think that was a bit of a surprise to a lot of the folks who were reading court tea leaves. Although, as I understand it, the court did put some limits on disparate impact in the FHA cases that will come. I'd also point out that the there's been quite a lot of criticism, particularly in the press, of the FHA case. The Wall Street Journal, for example, published an op-ed entitled "The Supreme Court's Disastrous Misreading of the Fair Housing Act." And there seems to be some sort of arguments that put forward that disparate impact remedy models can actually have unintended consequences. And it's that little piece that I thought I might push you a little bit on. You're very clear in your concern about discrimination that may follow from genetic testing. But I think on the other side of the ledger, there may be some extraordinary promise, in particularly in epigenetic information, leading to many new types of actions brought against governments, landlords, polluters. And I wondered whether you had any sense of how that sort of balances off, that we may well get tremendous positives from knowing a lot of stuff about epigenetic issues that perhaps will have a major impact on civil rights and similar kind of litigation.
From your question, I gather that you're saying, what about changes that are genetic changes brought about by the environment, particularly the environment that either a fetus or a newborn is exposed to, and that then results in genetic changes to that individual. And you're asking, in the future, could we see cases against environmental polluters or unsafe, you know, landlords of unsafe living conditions for that kind of harm, you know, epigenetic harm that has occurred? I think that's a really interesting question because the first question is, you know, what law, right? What law would that case be brought under? Because I'm not really certain that that's what GINA was designed for, right? Because GINA is very narrowly focused on two areas, which is healthcare insurance discrimination and employment discrimination. So when you're talking about harm that doesn't fall really in either of those two arenas, then you kind of have to look elsewhere for that. And the question is, you know, what law would you bring that case under? And I'm not completely sure that there is a health law that really covers that. I think maybe a wrongful life, you know, which is really a tort law case, might be one. And in a previous article, I've actually seen or I've actually argued that tort law could be used to cover some of the areas in which GINA falls short, you know, particularly when it comes to addressing harms that are outside the purview of GINA. So, for example, privacy harms resulting from the wrongful disclosure of genetic information. That was what my article covered, but the kind of harm you're talking about is really more, you know, harm done to the unborn, which obviously lingers. So I think that might fall really under a wrongful life suit, perhaps, or a wrongful birth, or some similar tort action.
Ah, very cutting-edge issues there in the tort space. And I was just wondering, you know, given that we're on the topic of damages and given that I was fortunate enough to be included in something that you organized, Ufoma, on large genetic databases and the potential trouble they might cause, I was wondering if you might be able to discuss that debate at the Room for Debate on the New York Times on how the plans of, say, a 23andMe or other companies that want to acquire large amounts of genetic data, while they have great potential for helping and for developing new cures, also create new kinds of risks that the legal system may not be ready for?
Yeah, that's a great question because, yeah, we really can't disclaim the utility of genetic testing, right? Genetic testing does have the ability to predict some propensity for disease. The issue is whether we give too much credit or we give too much power to what genetic testing really can do, and as a result, whether we're now giving up too much of our genetic information without really asking questions as to security of that information. And the debate that we participated in the New York Times was really around the actions of a genetic testing company, 23andMe, which had reached a $60 billion deal with Genentech, in which 23andMe gave Genentech access to its database of 700,000 individuals' genetic information for Genentech to then develop drugs for genetic diseases. And 23andMe had also reached similar deals with the drug company Pfizer and 12 other undisclosed partners. And the question is, how safe are these genetic databases in terms of really keeping our genetic information confidential? And how informed are the consumers of genetic testing when they are essentially relinquishing the privacy of their genetic information to these commercial companies. And I think that's a question we really should be asking as more and more people engage in genetic testing and as commercial companies seek to create these large genetic databases to benefit from. Because as we all know, we live in an age of data breaches. Every day, you know, recently there was one data breach at Anthem, which was a major health insurer. And these data breaches are so common these days. And there's no real guarantee, really, that our genetic information being housed in a genetic database by a commercial company can remain safe from such data breaches. And there are issues then, really, arising from the invasions of privacy that can result from third parties capturing this information. But something that I actually didn't address in the New York Times article for lack of space was the third party doctrine, right? As you know, the third party doctrine allows that information that's relinquished to a third party loses its expectation of privacy when you publicly make this available to a third party. So if consumers are relinquishing their genetic material to 23andMe, then is there any expectation of privacy still attached to that genetic material? Can the government request that material from 23andMe without a warrant? As you know, the third-party doctrine is an exception to the Fourth Amendment. So, you know, that's a major issue that really hasn't been addressed and that I'm hoping to address in an upcoming law review article.
So these are truly murky waters you're taking us into here, Ifeoma. I guess the HIPAA starting place is de-identification. Mm-hmm. But, of course, what you're leading us into is the problem of re-identification.
Exactly.
And re-identification that would not be prohibited by HIPAA, given that the data are de-identified in the two against the two models that HIPAA provides for. So the kinds of things, obviously, we've been looking at are with these large databases, have been re-identification through triangulation with other databases. And then more recently, we've been looking at some of the use of genetic information about third parties to sort of break the bank, so to speak, the security of the bank, and identify folks. And in a recent piece that I was involved in clinical epigenetics, we actually proposed that there should be far more controls over re-identification, primarily through the use of a use agreement for anyone who was researching in this area, a use agreement that would prohibit re-identification. But I wonder whether the tide is running against us, your concerns and mine, when we look at something like the 21st Century Cures Act that is being debated at the moment, which is clearly placing more import on the public goods aspects mm-hmm. of this kind of material compared to the private individual aspects that we've been talking about.
I certainly agree, and that's why I caution against us giving too much power to genetic testing, because the fact is genetic testing is still just one piece of the puzzle when it comes to fighting disease, right? What genetic testing really is giving us are probabilities of disease, and such probabilities are still very much affected by other contingencies such as environment, exercise, diet, So I think we really have to rethink how big a public good we think genetic testing is, and weigh that against the really credible harms that can still result if genetic testing is used for nefarious purposes, you know, whether for employment discrimination or for invasions of privacy.
In, I believe it was a presidential commission report or some important report from IOM, I'm trying to place it, they used the hypothetical that in the not-too-distant future, someone will just be able to look, watch you, watch me drinking a cup of coffee, watch us throw it into the wastebasket, come up behind us, take off the lid, and sequence the genes, and then they've got it, you know. And I mean, I think that's a really important privacy scenario and a problem, and I've raised it, you know. But then I recently had it turned around on me where people say, well, wait a second, why are you so worried about 23andMe given the ubiquity of this data and the potential ubiquity of the sequencing technology? One thought I had was that perhaps the 23andMe records had more than just the bare sequence. But would you have any other thoughts about that challenge, the challenge of, say, pervasive, ubiquitous genetic material and sensing?
Yeah, that's a really interesting problem that you bring up, which is really what's called the problem of abandoned DNA. So in the U.S., there's no blanket law against the use of abandoned DNA. So if, say, you were to spit out a piece of gum which you've been chewing and which has your DNA on it, and somebody else were to pick that gum up, that is not considered DNA theft by federal law. California does have a law against that. Because that would actually be considered abandoned DNA, such that somebody could pick up that piece of gum and send it into a lab. Most genetic testing labs prefer to remain agnostic about the provenance of the DNA that's being sent to them. So you can send it into any lab and they will sequence that genomic profile and you will have the information. So jurisdictions like the UK, for example, have actually passed laws against use of abandoned DNA. So they actually have a law called DNA theft, which is when you take someone else's DNA for your purposes. And it's interesting how that law came about, actually. It was actually because there was a plot to extract a piece of Prince Harry's hair and test it to discover if he was really the child of Prince Charles, because the rumor was that he was actually the son of a butler. So, you know, that's really why that UK law came about. But the US doesn't have any comparable law. So, you know, Frank, you're right that there is that danger of, in the near future, perhaps, genetic testing becoming so affordable or so accessible that as individuals, we would have to really take precautions about leaving our DNA anywhere, which is actually a very tough task to undertake, because obviously we shed DNA everywhere we go, through our skin, our hair. But I think that future is still far off, right? What we do have currently right now are genetic testing companies that have a vested interest in amassing as large a database as they possibly can of individual people's genomic profiles for purposes of then selling that data for research or other purposes. So I see the danger that you're mentioning, but I think we have a actually more immediate danger, which lies in the genetic databases.
And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Ifeoma, who can be found at IAJUNWA on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, Nick, and thank you so much, Frank, for inviting me. This was a lot of fun.
We post our show notes at twihl.com, that's twihl.com. And if you go to that site and you're in a generous mood, you can see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. You can contact me at Nicholas Terry, that's NicolasTerroy on Twitter. And Frank, where can you be found?
I am at Frank Pasquale or at HealthPI for Health, Privacy, and Innovation on Twitter.
Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.